We are always interested in hearing from you regarding current state segments here on WKAR. We've received several comments online at WKAR.org regarding our segment yesterday with MSU President Luana Simon. Now, President Simon is authorized to decide whether or not to pursue an auction of broadband spectrum that WKAR-TV uses to televise programs. That auction could lead to a transfer of the spectrum to other entities, and it could mean that WKAR television might come to pass in the near future and may communicate content through other means, but the televised could come to an end if all the subsequent steps unfold in the right way and the broadband goes to somebody else. One commenter writes, "With the number of cord cutters growing at an exponential rate and a significant number of TV viewers who were cord nevers, either by choice or necessity, forcing citizens to have to subscribe to cable in order to watch their local public TV station is not only counterintuitive, but also contrary to the very reason public TV was created in the first place." Another writes, "One could access the PBS content online and using Chromecast or Apple TV or similar products, watch PBS on a television screen without using a cable provider." So a variety of views responding to President Simon's appearance yesterday and the decision that she will be making soon whether or not to pursue the spectrum auction, which is being organized through the Federal Communications Commission. It is Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program, members of Congress are back in their home districts for the holiday break. Just before they adjourned, lawmakers passed and President Obama signed a $1.1 trillion federal budget. The massive omnibus spending bill averts a feared government shutdown, and it provides funding for several key priorities here in Michigan. Among other things, the package includes $100 million for the facility for rare isotope beams under construction here at Michigan State and $1 billion for Great Lakes projects. Joining me to talk about the newly signed federal budget, Michigan U.S. Senator Gary Peters. Senator Peters, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be with you, Mark. How are you doing today?
We're doing just fine here on the glide path to Christmas, as it were.
Wonderful. Well, wonderful. Well, Merry Christmas to you and happy holidays to your family.
Thank you, and back at you. Before we get into the new budget and what's in it, talk to us about what you're doing in Flint today. I know Senator Stabenow and Congressman Kildee are along with you there.
Well, we are. We're talking about a provision that was put into this omnibus, which you opened up this segment with, which deals with blight removal, part of the hardest hit funds that were still available as a result of what had happened after the Great Recession. And we were able to get funding for blight removal programs across the state. That has happened in the past. They've been extremely successful everywhere. We focused in our talk in Washington, particularly on some of the successes in Detroit, where there has been massive blight removal. And as a result of that blight removal in neighborhoods, it's stabilized neighborhoods. You've also seen property values come back up, which is important to bring residents back into our central cities. But these funds are available all across the state, including in Flint and Saginaw and in Lansing, the west side of the state, up in the UP. This is very important funding to give communities a tool to deal, particularly in their neighborhoods. And as you know, as important as a downtown district is or a central business district is to a city is not strong unless the neighborhoods are strong as well. And with large amounts of blight in our older areas we need to deal with, that we will be able to provide critical funding for these local programs. And that's what we'll be talking about in Flint later this morning. But this is a program really for the entire state of Michigan.
The EFRIB project, the funding, the $100 million for the EFRIB project here was of particular interest for people in the Lansing area. Was that ever in jeopardy, or were you confident that that would clear the Congress and be signed?
Well, we have to fight for it every appropriation cycle. So I wouldn't say it's in jeopardy, but it just doesn't happen. You also have to really get out there and work for it. This is a continuing payment on a project that's already well underway, as folks in Lansing know. In fact, the FRIB is ahead of schedule, which is always great to see a project, particularly of the magnitude of this and the complexity of it. It is actually ahead of schedule. But this is an incredible investment for the Lansing area, but also for the state of Michigan. This $100 million continues to put us on the path to fully fund that project. which will mean hundreds of jobs in the area. But more importantly, it really puts Michigan and the greater Lansing area on the map nationally and internationally as a center for nuclear physics, just cutting-edge research that's going to bring in thousands of leading researchers from around the world that will come to Michigan State University campus to work on this or work with the FRIB. So this is an incredible project for us in Michigan. And already Michigan State University has one of the leading nuclear physics programs in the country. I think they have more percentage-wise, more PhDs than any other university in the country. It's really quite a wonderful thing we have here in our state. And now with the FRIB, that program gets even stronger and will become one that has even a stronger international reputation.
I know the new budget includes $300 million in funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is all about, well, combating invasive species and a really a variety of measures promoting the general health of the Great Lakes. Was it hard coming up with that money, or do you detect notable reluctance from some in the Congress to fund this?
Well, it's difficult to get funding for anything now. You have to fight very aggressively to make that happen. I was encouraged, though, when it comes to Great Lakes funding. This is a big deal, this restoration, to make sure the Great Lakes continue to stay clean, and we try to make them even cleaner by dealing with some of the legacy pollution sites that we have around the lakes. But I was encouraged in that I'm finding with my colleagues in the Senate. In fact, I've been working on a pipeline safety bill, for example, to keep the Great Lakes clean from an oil spill. But what often and I want to say that because it's important, because I think it tells us a little bit about where members of Congress are now. In fact, that legislation I worked on got unanimous support in committee. And when you are dealing with issues related to something like the Great Lakes, for example, oftentimes it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It tends to be more of a regional issue.
Uh-huh.
And if you're on the west side of the country, that's different than if you're on the east side of the country or in the south, and everybody has their regional issues. But people really have been coming together and understanding that the Great Lakes is not a resource just for the Midwest and for Michigan and Wisconsin and other states. But the Great Lakes is really a resource for the whole country. And as the country and the world gets thirstier, people realize that having a body of fresh water as large as the Great Lakes is an incredible national asset that we have to do everything we can to protect. And so I'm starting to see some signs that we're transcending some of the regionalism that's associated with the Great Lakes and really now getting an appreciation from my colleagues around the country that this is a national asset that has to be protected and preserved.
We're talking about parts of the new $1 trillion plus federal budget Congress just passed last Friday, and President Obama quickly signed into law. Our guest is Michigan Senator Democrat Gary Peters. You alluded to the pipeline safety measure. Let's talk a little bit more about that. I mean, you're involved in that, which is obviously of concern in Michigan. A lot of people are aware of Enbridge's Line 5 running beneath the Straits of Mackinac. Talk about that measure and where we're at.
Well, I introduced a bill with Senator Stabenow. Together, we introduced a bill for pipeline safety to toughen the rules for oil pipelines around the country, but we focus primarily on the Great Lakes. And I was able to get a number of the key provisions in that legislation. I was able to get that inserted into the PHMSA reauthorization. PHMSA is the federal agency that oversees pipeline safety. As we were reauthorizing it through the Commerce Committee, many of the key provisions related to protecting the Great Lakes is inserted in that legislation. First and foremost, it will now designate all pipelines throughout the Great Lakes Basin as pipelines in high-consequence areas. And what that means is if you're in a high-consequence area, those pipelines are subjected to the strictest, most robust federal oversight when it comes to pipeline safety. We did not have that, for example, with the Kalamazoo pipeline. That, unfortunately, we had the big spill a few years ago that's already cost us over $1 billion in cleanup. Now that pipeline would be considered a high-consequence area, as all other pipelines throughout the Great Lakes. Line 5 you mentioned up in Mackinac, which is of particular concern to me, and as well as others throughout the state. But in addition to the Line 5 across the Straits of Mackinac, there's also a great concern about the pipeline as it goes across the entire Upper Peninsula, across to the Straits of Mackinac. And if you had a pipeline there and all of the feeders into Lake Michigan, for example, would be potentially catastrophic. That pipeline will now all be under these strict guidelines. The other aspect of the bill is that deals with ice cover, that we now have to look at ice cover, which surprisingly wasn't considered in the past. And if you're thinking of Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac, during the winter, that tends to be covered by thick, thick ice. And as difficult as it would to clean up a spill at any time of the year during thick ice cover makes it nearly impossible. We need to recognize that and take action accordingly.
The budget measure also lifts the oil export ban. I know many environmentalists, as I understand it, favored retaining that ban. How do you feel about that?
Well, I was very disappointed about that provision. I think it makes no sense to do that. This is we still import millions of barrels of oil every year into the United States, but the oil industry wanted to be able to export it and sell that American oil to China and other places, which doesn't make sense to me.
It's an economic stimulus, isn't it?
Well, you're still selling the oil to Americans. Americans are buying that oil, and now that you're we import millions of barrels. Now we're going to probably import even more oil because some of our American oil may be going overseas, and that could also increase the price because you've got now more markets for it to sell outside of the United States. So I think that's very troubling. And one aspect that's particularly troubling to me, we give very large tax breaks under the tax code to oil that's produced in the United States, and now those tax breaks continue. Even though that oil may be shipped to China, we now have a situation where American taxpayers are going to be subsidizing oil being sent to China.
The budget bill tightens the visa waiver program. There will be a higher level of scrutiny imposed on anyone who has traveled to Iran, Iraq, Sudan, and Syria in the past 5 years. If they want to enter the United States, there seems to be a consensus this was a good and necessary move, was it?
Oh, there's no question that visa waiver program was one that needed to be tightened. That's where most folks come in with limited screening as a result of that visa waiver. With those countries, we needed to tighten up that program. I think we'd have to continue to tighten that program. This is an important step, but we still have to move further. And one of the issues, and I serve on the Homeland Security Committee,
right,
in the Senate, and one of the issues still is making sure that those countries who are visa waiver countries even have that data about where folks have traveled who are in their country and whether or not that data is in a database that's easily accessible by our immigration officials as well. So this is a step. It's important. We have to continue to focus on it. But we're not done. We still have a lot more work to do.
Describe the tenor of this debate over whether to pause Syrian refugee resettlement. What was the tenor of that debate?
Well, I think it was off base. You know, I strongly support the refugee program, and when you look at trying to deal with a threat that may be coming from abroad, there was a focus on the refugee program, which is actually probably it is the most difficult way to come into the United States. It is one in which requires extensive background checks by the Department of Homeland Security, by the FBI, by the Department of State. The United Nations is involved. It's a process that takes 18 to 24 months for someone to come through and to be screened. That was now where our focus should be. Also, not to mention the fact that I believe that as a country and our values, we have borders that are open to those who face persecution and violence and are looking for a refuge. That's who we are as Americans. We have to have a robust screening process, but that already exists within the refugee program. Where we needed to be looking at tightening the process was in the visa waiver program. That's where the focus needs to be. That's what's happened in the omnibus. You don't see changes in the refugee program. Instead, you see focus on the waiver program, which is where it should be. And as I mentioned earlier, we still have some work to do in that area. But we need to focus on where the potential risks are and not politicize something that is not a risk. And in my mind also, not only was it politicizing something that wasn't a risk, it was politicizing something that goes to the very core of who we are as Americans and our values.
Let me ask you a broader question, a broader political question that relates to the budget. Gregory Corte in USA Today wrote that the spending bill represents a ceasefire, he called it, quote, a ceasefire in the battle over executive power. And he cites a series of compromises that the budget contained. For example, Congress allowed the president's clemency initiative to continue, but it didn't give him all of the funding that he wanted to run it. An earlier version of the bill would have killed the initiative altogether. Do you agree with this interpretation of the spending bill as a ceasefire in the battle over executive power?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot in the omnibus bill. And I think that the way to characterize it is that there was actually an encouraging aspect of it, is that it found some middle ground, that you saw Democrats, Republicans come together. It's including the administration. This was really a negotiation with the Congress and with the administration in a bipartisan way, with an awful lot of give and take. So the executive was able to retain make sure they could retain some of their powers. Congress wanted to retain some of their appropriation powers, which are the key to congressional powers, the ability to spend money. It's the power of the purse. So that is been retained, but it was really finding some of that middle ground.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you've got Republicans controlling both houses of the Congress, but you had to come up with a bill that the president would sign. So it kind of represents that degree of compromise. Let's talk politics for just one quick minute. A longtime Michigan Democratic insider, ardent Democrat, told me late last week that he is expecting some number of Democrats to cross over in Michigan's primary come March and vote for Donald Trump because they feel a Trump nomination would all but guarantee the general election to Hillary Clinton. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm a Democrat. I think Democrats, if they are Democrats, should stick to voting on the Democratic side and not get involved in Republican politics. Right now, Donald Trump is doing very well. He seems to speak for a large segment of the Republican Party, and I think it's up to the Republicans to determine who their nominee is. I believe I support Hillary Clinton. I believe she's going to run a strong race, will be our next president. As far as I'm concerned, it probably won't matter who the Republicans pick. Hillary Clinton will be our next president.
You really don't think it'll make any difference if Donald Trump or Marco Rubio, for example, were to be the Republican nominee in terms of the general election?
I always focus on a general election. It's what I've done myself, and I believe that the politics of the Republican Party right now, which is very far to the right, very much out of step with where most folks are in this country and what you're seeing in the primary. No matter who the candidate is, they're certainly appealing to the far right. There are some more so than others, but I do believe that the party in general is out of step with where the country is, and it's going to be difficult, no matter who the nominee is, to try to come back to the middle after they've spent the last couple of years really moving more and more to the right.
Democrat Gary Peters is Michigan's junior U.S. Senator. We've been talking about some of the provisions included in the new $1.1 trillion federal budget that Congress just passed late last week and that President Obama signed just before adjourning for the holidays. Senator Peters, Merry Christmas. Thank you for your time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and all the best to you and your family and all of your listeners. Hope everybody has a wonderful holiday season and all the best in the new year.
Thank you. Coming up on Current State, new research suggests that the world's lakes are experiencing a dramatic temperature shift due to climate change. So how will our own Great Lakes fare in a warming climate? We talked to John Lenters, a researcher at the water science consulting firm Limnotech in Ann Arbor, to find out. That's coming up later this hour. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Every year, the City of Lansing awards funds to support creative placemaking projects through the Sense of Place in the Arts program. The program's administered by LEAP and the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. The 2015-16 recipients have been announced, and joining us in the studio to tell us more about the winners is the president of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing, Debbie McCullough. Debbie, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
Also on the phone, we got Eric Larson, executive director of the Impression 5 Science Center. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Debbie, the City of Lansing awards these grants every year. Give us an example or two of the kinds of projects that these have funded in the past.
Yeah, we have, there's about $120,000 that are allocated through the City of Lansing and then through the Lansing Economic Development Corporation, and LEAP are administering these dollars. And the Arts Council actually does the technical assistance, the funding plan. We go through the review process. So about this year, about $45,000 went to the arts grants. And some of those grants, one of them went to Reach Studio Art Center, and they're creating what they are calling a sense fence around their new location down in Rio Town. And it's going to be a 70-foot interactive kind of sculpture fence that creates a probably a border between the neighborhood and the new outdoor area of the Reach Art Center.
But is there something that our listeners would know and recognize on the landscape here in Lansing that you can point to and say, yeah, that's the result of one of these grants?
I'm trying to think of last year's grants. We did some temporary placemaking projects. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra worked with the Capital City Film Festival, and they actually created through their silent film. They did the music behind the film over at the Lansing Center. They sold out. It was over 1,000 people came to see that during that time frame. So what placemaking is really bringing people together to help create a kind of a vibrant and dynamic place. So each of the arts organizations does something different. Some of them can be temporary projects, and some of them can be permanent projects. So we did a little bit of a switchover this year, we wanted to make sure that there were more permanent projects that were out there. The City of East Lansing did the bike racks, so they did 6 bike racks last year, they had six or seven different teams of artists that created their bike racks, and then they placed them throughout the city. So permanent or temporary, and those kinds of things are what we're really focused in on.
Eric Larson, let's work you into this. Tell us about the winning proposal for the Arts Impact Project.
Well, we had an amazing opportunity to, again, work together as a cultural district here at the end of Museum Drive for well over 30 years. Impression 5, the Riverwalk Theater, and what used to be the Surveying of Museum of Surveying, and then, of course, directly to the south of us, the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum, have all worked together in this small piece of property down here to try and bring as much attention to cultural tourism as possible. And we were presented this amazing opportunity to present a collaborative effort to create a permanent and high-value artistic installation at the top of Museum Drive that would really kind of identify the district for visitors, whether they be traveling from around the state or from right down the street. And so what we're going to be working here over the next number of months together, in a big thank you to the Arts Council for leading this process, and then, of course, the City of Lansing and LEAP for funding it. But Debbie is putting together a steering committee here that's helping us, all three of the partners, really create a brand for the cultural district of downtown Lansing. There's been so much development here in the core, and all of the nonprofits down here in the end of Museum Drive are seeing a nice uptick from that development. So it's now time for us to kind of raise the bar and make some improvements in wayfinding and also creative placemaking. And this project will be one of those big gateway investments to make sure people know exactly where they're headed when they're coming to the district.
We're speaking with Eric Larson, Executive Director of the Impression 5 Science Center, and Debbie McCullough, Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing, about the recipients of the 2015-16 Sense of Place in the Arts grants. Debbie, talk to us about what you visualize or what ideas are you hearing in terms of what people will see as they drive down Michigan Avenue and they look south, and you're trying to draw attention to this museum district.
Yeah.
What do you think will look good there? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, we had our first steering committee meeting, and it was kind of interesting because we're calling it a gateway, and the gateway on Michigan Avenue, which is we have to go through some processes with MDOT and things like that because they own that right of way. But we started talking about could we do something over top of the north and the south driveways going down into that? I call it a valley because you can't really see some of those buildings.
Well, it is a valley.
Yes, it is a valley, but it's also a trailhead for the river trail. So there's so many things that are down in that area that are culturally or natural resource kinds of things. And I think what we want to do is to draw attention to it. Right now, you see the backs of some of those buildings, and I think what Eric is doing and what Riverwalk is doing with trying to bring focus off of Michigan Avenue, so people that are over at the Lansing Center or driving down that gateway into our lovely, downtown, can actually recognize that there are some cultural amenities and cultural assets that they just don't recognize are down there.
We'll point out that there are a number of other recipients of grants, the Lansing Art Gallery, the Lansing Symphony, MICA, the Michigan Institute for Contemporary Art in Old Town, the Old Town Commercial Association, the Reach Studio Art Center, and Rio Town Commercial Association. Back to the placemaking that at Museum Drive, though. Eric, tell us about the next few steps. How are the coming months going to unfold? Where is this discussion going?
Well, I think it's going to be a really high-level discussion. I think that the interesting piece in this is that this is such a significant investment by the Arts Council in this city and LEAP. I mean, what they've really done here is said, you know what, we want to go big. We want to make a big investment, things that people will recognize as creative place-making investments. And so we want to make sure that we do this right. We want to make sure that we take into account all the factors. It could be relatively easy for us to say, you know what, let's just take this budget and put a sculpture at the top of Museum Drive and call it good. But that wouldn't allow us to meet the objective that we want to meet. And so the first step here is to really take a minute and actually create a brand for the district. And then when we get our heads wrapped around that and we're working with a local professional to help us do that, then we start to create some parameters of the project. It can be this big, it can be located here, and to Debbie's mention of MDOT and other folks that we have to make sure this is vetted through. And then we'll work with local artists to design what this would look like. And then we have to have it installed by October 6th, right, Debbie?
October
6th. Creative Placemaking
exactly.
Summit.
How can the public weigh in on this? I mean, how might they connect with someone on the steering committee, for example, or with you, Debbie?
Well, I think that what we'd love to have is input from the public. We're not quite there yet because we're going through this branding process. What is the cultural district? What does it entail? What is it? What could things be added into that area, or could we start to expand kind of our thought processes for what the cultural district is? So right now, until we kind of get more of the creative artistic piece into play, that's what we'll probably, I think we could be looking at. But they can call the Arts Council, they can talk to LEAP, they can talk to any of the cultural organizations that are in that area, and give them some input about what they'd like to see as well. It's got to be highly visible. It has to be, obviously, it's located in the city of Lansing because these are city of Lansing dollars that are going to support this project. And it has to have the highest artistic quality and creative quality that we can possibly get. So those are all of the things that, why is the Arts Council involved in economic development? Because that's where these dollars are headed. It helps to support the economic development goals of the city.
Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing, Debbie McCullough. We've also been talking with Eric Larson, Executive Director of the Impression 5 Science Center, about the recipients of the 2015 Sense of Place in the Arts grants, particularly what might be going into Museum Drive along Michigan Avenue. Debbie, Eric, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up on Current State, for nearly two decades, the Ark, Ann Arbor's folk music concert space, has celebrated Irish music with the post-Christmas Crossroad Cayley series. We'll hear from Mick Gavin, the fiddler and organizer for this two-night festival, about the concerts and what it's like to be in the Irish Music Hall of Fame. That and more after the break. We'll be right back. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for our staff music pick of the week. It's Scott Pohl's turn, and you have a new Christmas song for us, don't you?
That's right, Mark. My friends know that I have a large collection of Christmas music, a lot of it untraditional, stuff by blues singers and rock stars. My favorites are unconventional, like the Christmas albums by the Bare Naked Ladies and the Squirrel Nut Zippers. I try to get one new Christmas album every year, and this year I've turned to the Brooklyn-based Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings release, It's a Holiday Soul Party. You might have seen them on Michael Bublé's TV Christmas special or a recent NPR Tiny Desk concert. They do a few of the standards, but I particularly like Ain't No Chimneys in the Projects.
When I was a child, I used to wonder how Santa
This reminds me of the James Brown classic, Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto.
Right.
Fun, but with a message.
Exactly. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Ain't No Chimneys in the Projects. Thanks, Scott. Merry Christmas.
You too.
Now I'm all grown and I see.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. When you think about global warming, melting ice caps probably come to mind, or the picture or image of a polar bear adrift, perhaps. But the reality of climate change hits much closer to home. Recent research suggests that the world's lakes are warming much more rapidly than the ocean. That includes several of the Great Lakes. To learn more about how climate change is impacting our state's defining features is LimnoTech researcher John Lenters. John, welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
Why did you and the other researchers involved in this study want to look at lakes specifically?
Well, I mean, a lot of us have been working on lakes for quite some time, looking at the physics of lakes and the fish in lakes and how weather impacts lake ecosystems. And there was a study done back in 2010 by NASA where they used satellites to look at warming trends of lake surfaces around the world. And this was really the first attempt to do this globally. They looked at 167 lakes and found that many lakes around the world are warming rapidly, especially ones in northern high latitudes, especially the Great Lakes and northern Europe. But they also didn't include any field measurements. It was really just the big lakes that satellites could see. So we decided to bring together a lot of lake scientists around the world that had actual field data, gone out in boats and put buoys out and collected data on site, and put it all together in a bigger data set. And now we've nearly doubled the number of lakes in that database. And what we're essentially finding is that the field measurements match what the satellites are seeing.
So what can the changes in lake temperatures tell us about the impact of climate change?
Well, they're warming. They're warming rapidly. They're warming at about, well, just to give you an idea, the oceans are warming at about 0.1 degrees Celsius per decade. The Earth's air temperatures are warming three times faster than that, or twice as fast as that. And then the lakes themselves are warming three times as fast as that. So we're finding that the lakes themselves are warming at a greater rate than both the oceans and the air, which is it's a bit alarming. On the other hand, you could say we only have 235 lakes in the database, and many of them are clustered in the mid to high latitudes of the northern hemisphere. And that is actually where most of the rapid warming is happening, as you know, from loss of the ice caps and glaciers and snowpack and so forth. That's where many of these lakes are situated.
So the study looked at 235 altogether across the globe. How did you choose which lakes to include in the study?
Well, we started with the lakes that the satellite database already had, and by necessity, that's some of the larger ones, because back in the 1980s when the satellite data started, they only had a certain amount of resolution that the satellites can see, so that has to be lakes that are bigger than say 100 square kilometers or 6 miles on a side. And so that was the largest lakes. And then we picked a lot of lakes that had long temperature histories. And as you can imagine, going back to 1985, there aren't a lot of institutions in the world that have collected lake temperature data for over 25 years. And so we got as many as we could. And like I said, we doubled the database. This most recent study included 235 of those lakes in the database and did the same kind of processing we did with the satellite data.
We're talking to John Lenters, a researcher with the water science consulting firm Limnotech in Ann Arbor, about a recent report that shows the world's lakes, I beg your pardon, are seeing significant rises in temperature due to global climate change. Talk to us here broadly, John, about what you found in the Great Lakes then.
Well, the Great Lakes are what we kind of refer to as one of the hot spots on the globe. When we first started this study and compiling all the data back in 2010 and 2011, a couple years previous, there had been a study by a group at the University of Minnesota Duluth showing that Lake Superior is warming at a rate faster than its summer air temperatures. And another study came out from the southwest U.S., Lake Tahoe, Pyramid Lake, and some other lakes down there, showing the same thing. But the difference was the Great Lakes have ice cover and the lakes in the southwest do not. And so while the Great Lakes, it looked like maybe the cause was related to loss of ice cover, that can't be the cause for the lakes in the southwest U.S. And so we were a little bit confused as to why these lakes were warming more rapidly than their summer air temperatures. And so we thought, well, let's do a global study and see if we see similar patterns. And as it turns out, the Great Lakes, this global study helps to give us some context to the Great Lakes. And they are warming more rapidly than many lakes throughout the rest of the world. But there's also a lot of diversity within the Great Lakes. Lake Superior is the most rapidly warming. It's about three times the average of all the other lakes. So it's somewhere in the top 10 percentile of all the lakes in the world. Lake Erie, on the other hand, is warming less than the global average. And the other lakes are somewhere in between. And it largely falls out based on depth. And so the deeper the lake, the faster they're warming is a general pattern that we were finding. And it sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but if you think about the detailed physics of a lake, it actually kind of makes sense, and it has to do with the time at which spring arrives on a deep lake, and it's a period known as stratification, when we get warm water on top of cold water.
And that is why that's our best theory as to why the deep lakes might be warming more rapidly.
Yeah, and for Lake Superior in particular, it's kind of a perfect storm of factors. There's that factor. Spring is arriving earlier. The lake is stratifying earlier, and so the summer water temperatures are quite higher. And that actually has to do with what's going on in winter. Lake Superior is so deep that it's more strongly influenced by what goes on in winter than what goes on in summer. And then on top of that, it's losing ice cover, and ice does reflect sunlight, and that plays a bit of a role in the springtime in terms of how much heat goes into the lake. And on top of that, we found that there are decreases in cloud cover in different parts of the world, including Lake Superior. And when you get less cloud cover, you get more sunlight. That heats the water even more. And so you get this perfect storm of warming.
Lake Superior is one of the most rapidly warming lakes, as you say, increasing apparently about 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. That doesn't seem like a huge increase, but what impact can that kind of fluctuation have?
Well, you know, what's interesting is it's a degree Celsius per decade or 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And it turns out a good colleague of mine at the University of Minnesota Duluth and his grad student did an analysis of winter temperatures and winter ice cover. And they basically found that the difference between a year with no ice on Lake Superior and a year with a lot of ice on Lake Superior is the matter of 2 degrees Celsius. So averaged over a winter, that much of a difference can lead to ice or no ice on the world's largest lake. So that's a huge impact right there, just in terms of ice cover. Now, that being said, I will also mention that the summer water temperatures in the deepest parts of Lake Superior, where these changes are happening most rapidly, there we're talking about differences in temperature well beyond 2 degrees Fahrenheit.
The interesting.
Between a warm year and a cold year on Lake Superior can actually be more like 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And so the differences vary depending on where you are in the lake. Nearshore differences are not that great. Offshore differences are huge.
Talk to us about the ecological risks for warming lakes here? We've talked about the weather here, but what are the ecological risks involved here?
Sure. Well, the stratification thing I was talking about, the timing and the depth of that warm layer on top of the lake has a big impact on fish. Fish have a certain thermal habitat in which they like to hang out. Cold water fish will go deeper as the water's warm. Some tropical lakes are warming close to the point where they may start to become lethal for some of the warm water fish that are already in the lakes. So there's definitely impacts on fish abundance and distribution. There were some citations in this most recent study referring to previous work suggesting that there will be increases in algal blooms. The rates of warming we found in our study imply a 20% increase in algal blooms globally,
okay.
5% increase in toxic blooms, 4% increase
Very good.
In methane.
John, we're out of time. We're up against a hard break, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, no problem.
We want to thank you for joining us. John Lenters is a researcher with LimnoTech, a water science consulting firm in Ann Arbor. We've been talking about how climate change may be impacting the water temperatures in the Great Lakes. John, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
This weekend, the ARC in Ann Arbor is celebrating Irish folk music with its traditional post-Christmas Crossroads Ceilidh concerts, which have been going on for nearly two decades. I'm joined now by Current State's Jamie Paisley, who spoke with the man who started this concert series, Mick Gavin. Tell us about Mick Gavin, Jamie.
Well, Mick Gavin is originally from County Clare over in Ireland, and I would certainly bet that he's kissed the Blarney Stone and received that oh-so-wonderful gift of gab. The fiddler recently turned 70 years old this summer, and although he is deeply Irish, he credits a rather different country with his style of violin playing.
Fiddling as we know it, its origin would be Scotland. It was very big. Fiddle music was very big in Scotland going back, into the 1600s, 1700s.
And then how did it migrate over then?
Well, of course, the Scottish immigrated just like many, many, many other people. And actually, the Scottish music came into Ireland as well. There was big influences into, into Ulster. The first Scots came in there in 1610. And a funny thing happened in 1951 when they revived the traditional music competition. It used to be called the Feisne, which means the festival and competition, back in the 1800s, in the 1880s and 90s. But a group of people got together in 1950-51 to make sure that the music wouldn't die. And they formed an organization called Cultus Culturae Éireann. Today they have 400 branches across all over the world. But in the mid-50s, when they were having the Irish fiddle competition, it was held in the Midlands, and the fiddlers came down from Antrim and Fermanagh, and that would be Ulster. Now, they were of Scottish descent, and the adjudicators disqualified them. And the reason disqualified them was, they said, you played Scottish tunes. Well, they were originally Scottish people, and I suppose, brought music books in from Scotland, and a lot of music came in from Scotland. It's all connected to clan marches. That structure of music, Irish music today, Scottish music. Of course, it's been added to all the time by composers and by better and better musicians.
Right down the street, we're just a bit south of the Arc. And the Arc is the people putting on this weekend's event, right? But it's not taking place in the Arc. We're somewhere else. Where are we right now?
We're at Conor O'Neill's, Main Street, Ann Arbor. We're only a couple of doors from the Arc, actually. This is the concert at the Arc. Is something I've been putting on for, 18, 19, almost 20 years. I can't remember. It was David Siglin when he was director of the Arc. And, of course, David was part founder of the Arc, he and his wife. I worked there doing some tile work and with a lot of carpenters, painters, and plumbers and everything. And then David said there was an opening between Christmas and New Year. And it would be a good time to put on a concert. So it took off. For the first few years, we had local people, and then as some youngsters came along trying to learn fiddle and different instruments, I brought in a musician from Boston named Seamus Connolly. He was a 10-time All-Ireland fiddle champion, about my own age, give or take a couple of years, and from the same neck of the woods as I am, from County Clare in Ireland.
Now, when you started, it was just to fill something between Christmas and New Year's. Was it only one night to begin with? Because now it's two. You've got two nights.
Well, yeah, it was one night to begin with.
How did that expand to double the size?
Well, at the time, there were four young people from the Detroit area who were in Riverdance, and they were championship Irish step dancers. And I had invited them to perform with me at the Arc. We finished up with about 200 people outside the door in the Arc, and seemingly told to the director of the Arc, David Siglin, and his wife, that I said that, you know, come along. But I actually never said that. I have no recollection of saying that. I may have invited him to come and see the concert. But we sold it out with the youngsters from Riverdance, with their families and friends. So then we decided the following year we'd go two nights. I think that makes it a little more prestigious, probably a little more attractive.
We're speaking with Mick Gavin, the founder and curator, I guess, of the Crossroads Cayley concert coming up this weekend, put on by the Arc and Connor O'Neill's. We've talked a bit about the guests that you have, and there's one group that has a fantastic name, Behind the Times. How did you get involved with that group, Behind the Times?
Well, I met some of the people from Behind the Times at the Gaelic League in Detroit, and we were just sitting around having a session, you know, just playing some tunes. And I got talking to this guy, Ben Luthermoser, which is really German, and a really nice guy. Played guitar, you know, played bass and sang. And we had a concert at Tom's Tavern, a little place on 7 Mile in Detroit, a landmark little dive. People have crashed into it and stuff like that. And then they patched it up with plywood. But it's amazing the musicianship that's in there.
The name of this one is Crossroads Cayley, right? Where does the crossroads come from?
Well, initially, when I started it, I had three brothers from Dearborn play with me who came from the Scottish Cape Breton. Steve played the Highland Pipes. He won the North American Championship under 18. Played the pipes in a very fiddle style almost, a fiddle tempo.
How do you do that with a fiddle style?
Well, bending
a bit?
I'm talking about fiddle tunes and fiddle tempo. It wouldn't be just somebody playing, you know, Land of the Highlands, just some Scottish or, you know, some simple Scottish tune or march. This guy is quite an accomplished pibroch. They call it the pibroch, you know, the real guttural Scottish, original Scottish Highland stuff, you know. Of course, you have thousands and thousands of people all over the world that play the great Scottish Highland pipe. But real good Scottish Highland pipers are very few and far between. You'll find them with the Battlefield Band and bands out of Scotland.
Yeah.
And big, big difference, you know, between those and guys that put on the kilt and the skein dove and the spurn and, and march. That's America, you know, why not? Why not? I think the vast majority of groups, people who come to the Arc, of course, want to be very, very professional. Well, I've never considered myself a professional musician or good enough to be. Me, myself, I mean, I was a tradesman and that's how I made my living. And I played my fiddle on the weekends for parties, for weddings, in pubs. I played it, you know, only for my fiddle. I wouldn't be in America if I didn't play my fiddle. That's how I came here.
Well, even though you don't think yourself professional, if you've been doing this for nearly 20 years, people like it plenty.
Thank you very much.
Join Mick Gavin and friends this Saturday and Sunday evening at Connor O'Neill's Restaurant and Pub in Ann Arbor for this Crossroads Kaylee concert sponsored by and located just a few doors down from The Arc on Main Street, Ann Arbor. Tickets and more information online at thearc.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, yeah, we'll be here. Lansing pollster and Politico Mark Grebner weighs in on some of the presidential candidates, the state's ban on straight ticket voting, and Michigan's approaching presidential primary. Plus, it's the new hot spot in Lansing's Old Town, and now that the Creole Restaurant and Coffee Company is fully open, we'll speak with some of the foodies behind this Nolens-themed venture. That and more Wednesday on Current State. We're glad you could join us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.